top shake, a shake. Is that approximately true, Dave? Over to you, Dave, KQLAW.
And to APG. Yeah, they bring to every demonstration, they bring 7 jets. 6 fly in the demo, 1 is a spare. They've never missed a performance due to mechanical problems. In fact, about 2 or 3 years ago, when they were here, I witnessed that happen on takeoff. You know, they were getting ready to fly the demo. So the 6 planes were in the process of, you know, starting up, so to speak, and to leave. And one of the planes out of the 6, apparently, there was some sort of trouble. The pilot had to jump out of that one plane, run across the tarmac, and jump into the spare plane. And he took the spare plane up for the demonstration. But they've never missed a performance due to a mechanical problem. You know, each plane has its own team of maintenance people. And when I was at Republic 2 days ago or 3 days ago watching them, I had my binoculars, one of the maintenance people went over to the plane with a little metal can in her hand with a brush on top of it, and she did a little touching up on the finish of one of the planes with this little can and this little brush.
Wow. In that choreographed procedure by which the pilots climb into the cockpit, all the harnessing gets adjusted and all the electronics gets adjusted and the ejection mechanism gets properly attached to them and so on. And then eventually they start up the engine. Before they actually move away from the parking position, I'm wondering, is there a technician assigned to each aircraft that stands near the tail of the airplane just looking at the exhaust to make sure that everything's all right? I wonder if there's a ground crew person standing near the tail of each aircraft at the beginning of the procedure for them to do a rollout. Over to you, Dave, KQRIW.
Leo, when you get a chance, thanks.
And Rich is recognizing them. And to APG. Yeah, they have ground crew that, again, for each plane, they have a ground crew. And everything is checked. And before the pilot leaves, you know, to fly, he goes through the whole check, and they're watching the whole plane to make sure all the surfaces are operating properly, moving the way they're supposed to, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When all that is done, you know, they give the go-ahead, and the pilot can leave. But, you know, it's fascinating because all pilots are trained to do a walk-around, to do an inspection of their plane before they fly. The Blue Angels pilots, probably the Thunderbird pilots, are the only pilots that don't do that. And the reason they don't do that is because they have absolute trust in their ground crew, that when the ground crew says the plane is ready to go, it's ready to go. And the last thing that happens before they lower the canopy is that the pilot shakes hands with his crew chief. And the crew chief is saying, you're good to go, your plane is ready, here's my hand.
Interesting. And before we go over to Rich, let me ask you another question. That is, do they run up the engine to a high thrust before leaving the parking position? Do they do any kind of a check of the engine at near maximum thrust with the brakes on, of course, to say that, hey, this engine's in great shape after I just warmed it up? Over to you, Dave.
I don't think so. Because they do sit for a while after the engines are started. They do sit for a certain period of time. It might be 5 minutes, you know, it might be 7 minutes, maybe it's 8 minutes, I don't know. I don't think they rev it up higher, so to speak. I don't hear that, but they'll sit there for a certain period of time and, you know, with the engines running before they leave. So I don't know if that's considered a warm-up period for a jet engine or something like that, or they're just watching their instruments to, you know, to make sure everything looks good before they leave. But no, you don't hear them, you don't hear the power increase while they're sitting there, for instance, with their brakes on. You don't hear that. Maybe they do that, you know, at the end of the runway before they leave, but in the parking area, you know, where they're set up. You don't hear that happen.
Checklist.
Yeah, tell me about starting that engine. Is there an auxiliary power unit on the aircraft that starts the engine? Or is there a piece of ground equipment that gets plugged in order to start the engine? Over to you, Dave.
Well, they fly the Hornets, the Super Hornet, FA-18. There's nothing plugged into the plane when they start. They're all sitting there all by themselves. There's no wires, no cable, nothing. So there must be an APU, obviously, that powers the plane. They have two engines, and obviously, well, they start one at a time. And the sound is quite awesome. You know, you hear one engine spool up and start, and then after a period, the other engine will start up.
Yeah, let's go to Rich and then John in that order. N2EO, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, fine, Dick. Well, look, now that I'm starting to get ambulatory, or nearly, I want to go over to the public airport, maybe get a ride over there. Somebody, I don't know who it was, told me there's a museum in the public. I had no idea. That's one thing. And I wanted to know, I noticed on movies, maybe it's old time, I don't know, there would be ground crew, when the plane would start up, there'd be somebody with a crank, turning a hand crank on the side of the plane, and then he'd pull the crank out and the plane would take off. I don't know if that's still being done or not. Back to that.
Yeah, that's not being done anymore. Old days, I think they did it that way. And is there a museum there, Dave? N2APG, K2RIW?
Yeah, there's American Air Power Museum, I believe it is. And it's, you know, a nice collection of World War II era and other, you know, planes and things, vintage planes. And I think the Great South Bay Club actually is involved with them a little bit. You know, with some special events and things like that. So if Rich maybe gets in touch with the Great South Bay people, they probably could tell him a lot more than I can.
KC2WGB, K2RW, you got it, John.
Yeah, part of that waiting that Dave was talking about, you know, they're checking the radios and they're going over their flight list and flight check. That's basically what they're waiting there for. And then, of course, you know, permission to do whatever they have to do. But that's some of that delay.
Okay, I'm hearing somebody else say something. Go right ahead.
Yeah, this is N1YDY again. I know that I heard you guys calling me earlier. I'm sorry, the smoke detector went off in the house. I had to go figure out what that was about. But normally, a jet engine that starts isn't run up at the end of the runway. Normally, what you're waiting for is thermal stabilization so that you don't have thermal shock on takeoff. So you wait for certain indicators, either ETC or ITC temperature, that would give you an indication or give the pilot an indication that the aircraft and the engine has gotten warm enough that when they apply takeoff power, they're not going to suffer some kind of thermal shock damage.
That's good to know, YDY. Bob. Oh, sorry about that. Hank. And I had an earlier question. Oh, yes. You seem to know something about the actual transceivers, the radios that are on board, and where Dave believes they were using three simultaneous frequencies today, roughly 237, 275, and 284. Is the radio on board capable of listening to three frequencies at once, and all those audios are combined into the phone? That's a guess on my part. N1YDY, K2RW, you got it, Hank.
Yes and no. Can they listen to all three frequencies concurrently? Yes, but it's not one radio with the ability to monitor three systems. Essentially, depending upon the aircraft, three or four radios, and then there's a mixer box. The output of the radio, actually the radio head itself, the thing a pilot sees, allows him to select buttons, and the frequencies are usually channelized in military aircraft, sometimes in civilian airplanes. You actually get to rotate through the VHF frequency and select them in the same way we do in a VFO and an amateur radio. But what ends up happening is there's no volume on the actual radio head. The volume is in a mixer head, and then you actually select which one you transmit by pressing a button on the mixer, and you select which one you're listening to. A number of ways to do it. The most common these days is that there are a series of volume knobs that are very thin, and you select one by pushing it in. When you push it in, it actually, you know, provides an output from the radio to either the speaker or the headset, in case of the guy flying a tactical jet. And so anyway, the radios themselves talk to a mixer box, and the mixer box is what the pilot uses to figure out which radio he's going to listen to. I hope that answers your question in one way anyway.
Very well, Hank. A lot of good information there. I know it's quite late at your house tonight, Hank, and therefore you might be speaking very softly not to wake anyone else. You've got nice, clean RF into the machine, but your audio is a bit low, and you're probably speaking softly. Is that true, Hank?
Yes, and I might also be guilty of turning the mic a little sideways. I haven't figured out which way this particular radio sounds best.
Yeah, that was a lot of improvement. That was a lot more audio. You know what I sound like right now, and I'm going to try to make my voice sound about the way yours did.
And it was about this loud. So this is the way I was hearing it.
And you could have given us quite a bit more audio. As you can tell, I'm a real non-enthusiast of the new FCC mandate to make all the radios super narrow for commercial services. I think the person making that decision really didn't understand the physics involved. I bet you he was an attorney. And just making all the radios narrow, so now you've got twice as many channels, so to speak. On paper, sounds good, but there's a whole lot of technical reasons why I'm convinced that's not a good approach. As you know, that many of the Baofeng radios you can buy, let me drop it, are really set up for commercial servers, and they are honoring the new narrow band frequency deviation mandate of the FCC. And so quite a few of us, depending on which vintage and serial number radio we get from Roxxon and Baofeng, many of us are having trouble with low audio if we don't eat the microphone and shout into it. Over to you for any comments on all the above, Hank, KQRIW.
Very good, Dick. This is a Kenwood. It's actually a mobile rig, so I shouldn't be too involved with the narrow stuff. This is one of those TM-281As. Sold it with a reasonable radio, and it had a coupon, which is it made it quite affordable when I was in the AM radio outlet down in Delaware. But anyway, so I'm not really a technical fan of the narrow banding as you are. I'm sure you are correct with your insightful view of who the attorney was who actually made the decision. But nonetheless, I'm hoping that I'll come across a little bit better now that I'm holding the microphone a little differently.
Beautiful audio. A little bit of popping of the speech because you're as close as you are, but good sounding audio. That's a much better way to go. I am guessing, Hank, that you quite possibly are a private pilot or a commercial pilot. Is that true, Hank?
Well, I was until I got sick.
Understand. And one of the things that amazes the daylights out of me is that when it comes to a propeller-driven airplane, everyone accepts the fact that the propeller blows air over the fuselage onto the vertical stabilizer and so on. The air coming back over the fuselage is what really gives you the thrust. No one has any doubt of that. And because of the swirling of that air, in the case of a small private airplane, you're going to kick a little bit of right rudder as you go down the airfield, down the runway to take off, in order to compensate for what the swirling of the air from the propeller is doing. So the rotary wing, called propeller blade, is obviously pushing air downward compared to that blade. The wing is a non-rotary airfoil. And yet, almost every pilot doesn't think about the air being deflected downward by a wing, but the air is being deflected by the rotary wing called propeller blade. Ain't that a wild contrast? Over to you, Hank, KQLIW.
I think we've had this conversation before, and, you know, once again, the split between Newtonian lift and Bernoulli's lift is kind of well documented. You and I have actually talked about that crash in Jamaica Bay a few times, and you had some opinions that differed from mine. And actually, when you're talking about right rudder on takeoff, you're really talking more about the left-turning tendencies that must be overcome, and there's a couple of them. It's not just P-factor or the swirl, but it actually relates to the ascending and descending blade and the change of the angle of incidence as the aircraft moves forward. And in fact, the propeller as a rotor wing, as you call it, which I usually refer to the rotor disc in a helicopter with that terminology. I prefer to just call it propeller or propeller. Actually generates a fair amount of lift, which is what pulls the aircraft along, as well as the Newtonian thrust that pushes the air back. So you do get both. That's why a propeller actually has a foil shape, a NACA shape, which you can look up on the internet.
I understand. I wasn't going to go too deep into that tonight. I know you and I have had a lot of discussion, a lot of emails back and forth on this one. And you're saying Newtonian versus Bernoulli, where the lift is coming from, is well documented. Yes and no. The people who read that article that you and I shared, to those people who don't consider the article phony, and a few people do, to those people it's well documented. But I suspect that an extremely high percentage of today's pilots, both private and commercial, think that the vast majority of the lift is due to Bernoulli. And that causes them to make certain decisions that I think are dangerous. Okay, we won't go there right now. Been down that road before. Let's see now. I think we've gone down the list of everybody who signed in who had a question. Let me ask you a question, John. You've been watching that website tonight for those who are using EchoLink. I'm amazed that none of them had any questions. Are any of them still there, or have we put them all to bed, John? KC2WGB, KQLIW in the TechNet.
No, Dick, we still have five on the queue. Nobody's asking questions. And also nothing on the chat room. I was checking that at the same time. But by the way, the reason I was not able to monitor the frequencies that Dave was talking about on Friday, I got whacked big time by lightning. Oh, boy. Boy, what a nightmare.
Okay, you guys in the New York City area, in the five boroughs, saw some pretty wicked weather in the last couple of days. I got nothing but some drizzle out here, and in the far, far distance, I heard some rumbling of thunder. But tell me, I think ABC or NBC News in the last day or so has shown some live video, not live, but recorded video of lightning striking both Empire State Building and the new World Trade Center, the new Freedom Tower. So, and I think either hail or tornadoes got as far north as Albany in the last few days. You're probably a little more informed on all this than I am. So what did Mother Nature's weather do to you recently, John? KC2WGB, KQLIW.
KC2WGB. Well, Dick, I was leaving the lab, which is about 50 feet from my house. I was walking over to the house. I got about halfway, and about a half a block away, there was a lightning strike. It was enormous. The sun, I wish it shot me. And I turned to look at it, and I said, okay, the house cut off the view, but I saw where it came down about a half a block away. I was just about to turn my head when another one struck, which was maybe 5 seconds after that first one. And it hit my long wire connected to my VLF receiver. That wire is 70 feet long, and it's gone. Direct hit. And it was very strange. It looked to me like the bolt came down to approximately tree level, maybe 40, 50 feet. And then it looked like it broke into a trident, three different strikes, right on the antenna. Now, one of them may have went to ground. I'm not sure, but two of them definitely hit the antenna and just evaporated.
Wow. It sounds to me like you're a small number of feet away. This long wire antenna of yours for your VLF receiver, I'm guessing it's below tree level. so the lightning, so to speak, penetrated tree level to hit that wire, vaporize that wire. Tell me what happened to your transmission line, what happened to your VLF receiver, anything else in the house damaged by this, and guarantee this got your attention, because it sounds to me like the whole event was like 40 feet away from you. Over to you, John, KQLIW.
Oh, you got the distance pretty accurate, Dick. Yeah, I was about 40 feet away. The antenna wire, I did find it in the neighbor's yard, pieces of it here and there. But I think what saved me, it did not enter the shack at all. No damage. The VLF receiver, the ground strap was on, so that must have protected that from getting any stray voltage. But what I think saved me is at the long, the southern run, there is an angle iron rod about maybe an inch and a half by inch and a half that was in the ground. The antenna is only 12 feet off the ground for the VLF antenna, and it works fine. What I had done many years ago when I made up my egg insulators, let me let it drop, I placed two nails. I had epoxied them onto the egg insulators, and they were separated by about maybe a 16th, maybe an eighth of an inch, somewhere around there. And of course, the ground rod was attached to one end, the antenna the other. And I think that's what saved me from getting any severe damage in the shaft. I had one of those at both ends, so I'm hoping that was it. And if I put it back up, I will do the same thing. But it was scary. It shook me. Only oh boy, did it shake me.
Did your epoxy nails become damaged in this event, John?
No, they didn't even have any black marks on the nails. But on the porcelain insulators, there was a trace of approximately in the center of the nail. Not bad, though. I would expect to see it. I thought it would even be broken, but it didn't.
I'm going to pick up with Rich in a minute. As you know, the cloud-to-ground lightning, a high percentage of the time, the cloud is negatively charged, and you get a nice lightning bolt out of that. A small percentage of the time, for reasons that are a little mysterious, the cloud becomes positively charged. A positively charged cloud, and that cloud-to-ground lightning, is about 10 times louder, and about 10 times higher in amperes. So once every few years, you get a lightning storm that's local with positive polarity to it. And boy, those are really scary lightning bolts. And it sounds to me like you may have run into one of those in this particular case. It'd be nice if you and I had an E-field indicator that could tell the difference between positive and negative voltage on that cloud. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
T2WGB. Dick, we have to let it drop. Somebody on Echolink is trying to get in. KC2WGB, Echo Link Station, pick it up.
K2RIW in the group, WA2KBC. Just want to say hi. Let you know that after the carrier on the machine drops, there's about a 1 second delay till the Echo Link users hear the carrier drop, and then they can possibly get in and try to key things up. Just an FYI, I've been doing some timing and testing tonight, and I'd like to take it offline with someone when you're interested.
Yeah, I think you should be discussing this with Eric, KE2EJ, who is the technical maven that maintains the thing. TDC, I think you said. Bruce, is it? Are you? Oh, that's W1. I got the wrong call letters. Give me your call letters phonetically, TDC, K2RIW.
QBC, quick. Quebec Bravo Charlie, it's Bruce. I'm over in New Jersey, and yeah, I'll work with whomever. I can do some timings over here. I've got a little bit of instrumentation available, and I'm very familiar with voice over IP, so I've got some insights.
Yeah, I wonder if Eric is available. QBC, Quebec Bravo Charlie, I think it is. Sure enough, Hawk Ridge, New Jersey. I wonder if you're within range where, with a high enough antenna, you could be talking to us with RF. Let's see if Eric is available. KE2J, K2RIW, around Eric. just saying, Bruce, that the carrier has to drop, and then you have to wait a full 1 or 2 seconds before you have the ability to come in with Echolink. And that sounds like there is a kind of latency of the internet connection. And one of the things we were discussing at the very beginning of the net tonight was that whenever machines are connected by an internet connection, like our eastern end of Long Island machine and our western Long Island machine, sometimes when you start the link, you've got a tenth of a second delay, and for reasons that are mysterious to me, an hour downrange, the latency can build up to 2 or 3 seconds. Maybe you're familiar with that, Bruce. KBHQBC, KQLAW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Yes, Dick, hi. WHQBC. I don't see 2 or 3 seconds build up in delay. What I did measure, and this is unscientific, is I can listen over the air. I can barely hear the machine where I'm located here, at least on the antenna that I've got at the moment. My guess is about a 1 second delay between the audio on the RF side coming out of the machine compared to the audio coming out of my tablet that's running the Echolink application on Android. Most of that delay is not due to the internet. I did measure the delay between my IP address and the approximate delay to the IP address to the repeater site, and it's only on the order of about 30 milliseconds. The rest of the day, delay is due to various voice over IP things, both on the sending side and the receiving side. The majority of the delay, I don't know where it's coming from yet, but I can only account for maybe 250 milliseconds of total, and it's, I'm guessing it's about a 1 second delay based on what the eardrum hears.
Is any of the data coming into your computer going to a computer program where a kind of translation is required? Is there any possibility of latency there, Bruce Grant?
Okay, the general idea was IP listens for example. It typically, in normal voice over IP, like in millisecond delay getting in, plus whatever the computer latency, which is pretty much negligible at that point in the overall scheme. On the playout side, there's something called de-jitter buffering, because you've got jitter in the internet, which is basically variable, unpredictable delay. Seems to run 80 to 100 millisecond range in most apps that I've seen, sometimes a little bit higher. You've got delays on the internet, and then you've got a bunch more delay, which I don't understand where it's coming from, based on some of the unscientific measurements I did tonight. And that's the give you something to do with the application software on one end or the other. But the Echolink users can't get in until the carrier on the repeater drops, and then the Echolink users will hear that about a second later, and then they can try to get in. So that's kind of what's going on here.
And Dick, that's what UPS has been saying.
I'm letting it drop. So I think if I understand you correctly, Bruce, we have to periodically let the machine drop all the way and wait a couple of seconds beyond to be sure. And I guess by some kind of a menu, like maybe every 10 minutes or so, we do a complete machine reset like that so that people who don't want to say, who do want to say something on Echolink can get a chance to do it. Until this problem is alleviated by Eric, who is working on a scheme to make improvements, is there something like that that you would recommend, Bruce, that with some kind of a preordained schedule, Every 10 minutes, we make sure we let the machines thoroughly drop so Echolink people stand a chance. WA2QBC, K2LAW.
In the group, WA2QBC. Yeah, you'll need to do something like that. I don't know what kind of scheduling you'd like to use. It's a little difficult to get in, because at least it's on an Android tablet. I don't know how Apple would work. I haven't played with Windows recently, although I do have current Win 7 running with Echolink on. The Mac version of Echolink doesn't seem to yet. I don't know. But there's, like I say, about a 1 second delay between what you hear over the air and here on the end of the Echolink on the software side. And it seems to be kind of carrier dropping on the machine rather than the squelch tail. So if you could eliminate and key off the squelch tail and the carrier tail. I think I had a little bit of technical difficulty on this end. I'm back.
All is well, Bruce. Not to worry. And the technical difficulty was not on your end. It was on our end. I wonder what you've got an opinion on this one, John. Would we be satisfying people? Were you monitoring the Echolink website? Is a good way of finding out what's going on. I wonder if we should set some kind of a schedule where every 10 minutes we make sure we let the machine thoroughly drop, not only for reset reasons, so that the people with the long delay stand a chance of getting in. I'm getting the impression that not everyone experiences the same delay, depending on what part of the country they're in and how long downrange we've been using Echolink, so to speak. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the deck net.
Well, I think what Bruce is recommending is good. We could try that, but also remember, they can type in the word break, hit the space bar, it will announce their call. Also, now that I'm viewing it, all they have to do is, they could put a note in there, I have a question, and I will see that come up, and I will interrupt the net, or, when you're finished on that topic, we'll go on to that person who's waiting. We could do that until Eric gets this resolved. I think, using all of those solutions should be an answer.
That sounds very good, John. In the phone call you and I had today, I think you were telling me you also have the ability to monitor a website that tells you how many people are listening by IRLP or trying to get in by that means. That's question number one. And question number two, does everybody, no matter where they are, have the ability to type in the word break and their call letters will be announced? Is that universal? Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Dick, that's my impression. I could be wrong. I was going to ask Eric that, but he's disappeared. But we will find out if that's possible. But I know definitely all the all the Limart members do it, and I believe people from outside do it, not being members. So I think that's something we do have to check out. And I don't have anything with IRLP at all, just Echolink.
You did mention some of the monitoring today that you're capable of doing. Echolink was one, and what was the other one you said? You and I were making jokes about whether or not you've got enough computers and enough sets of eyes to do all this monitoring. Over to you, John.
Yes, Dick. I watched the mailbag on the email, and I'm looking at chat room too, which is what NY2H set up for us. It works well, but not too many users. Tonight, there was only three that signed on, but nobody had questions. But I did catch them signing on. Last week, there was a question on the chat room, so I try to pay attention to as many things as I can. So far, it's working pretty good, Dick. Back to you.
I let it drop all the way because I was hearing another voice in the background as if someone else was trying to get in. Anyone else trying to get an edge in word-wise? Let it drop by now and give us your call.
I don't know if you heard before. I went in the chat room on the Echo Link, and I typed in the word break. I don't know if you heard any announcement about 20 or 30 seconds ago. But anyway, I'm back, and I'm just listening here on the side, WA2QVC.
Let me check that out, Dick. I'll see if it's working.
Over Echo Link. Okay, Bruce, I think you said you typed the word break, and I don't think we heard your call letters being announced. Is someone else making a transmission right now? Go ahead.
KC2WGB.
It's working on Echo Link.
QBC.
Aha! I did hear KC2WGB, and I did hear QBC. So this time it worked. When you said you did it earlier, Bruce, I didn't hear it come through. Just for the heck of it, Bruce, give us one more of those. W2QBC, K2LAW.
In general. Yeah, there is some difference in latency of the internet component itself, which is only a very small part of this. And I'm local in the New York metro area. I go from Cablevision to Time Warner, which is what the repeater is connected to. And that's about 30 milliseconds round trip. But if you go to the West Coast, you're only going to see about 60 milliseconds round trip. So there's not an appreciable increase in the overall delay components there. As I said, to me, just as a guess, between the audio coming out of the RF and the audio coming out of the Echo Link app is about
10.2 MB.
Excuse me, Troy. It evidently works. 10.2 MB.
Well done, Barry. We heard your call letters come through. And would that come through even if somebody was transmitting at the time? Do you believe, Barry? And Barry, you have reason to believe that anybody in on planet Earth who's connected to Echo Link and this particular node, that if he types the word break, his call letters will come through. You have reason to believe that that's a universal N2 moonbound, K2LAW?
Yeah, I think it would. The only thing I tried is while you were talking, I tried it and it didn't go through. So it has to be, I got to turn this down, okay.
QBC.
Yeah, I had to shut it off for a minute. Yeah, I think it'll work, but I didn't appear to come through while you were talking. That's the only thing I didn't see.
Okay, that's a little bit discouraging. If we get a bunch of guys that are running hot and heavy, and they're picking up real fast, not leaving enough drop time, then I think you're saying that the voice announcement of the call letters might not come through. Therefore, I'm now wondering how much of a cure that break function is if it can't override audio of guys that are quick on the uptake. Over to you, Barry, in 2MB, KQLAW. Wait for the beep.
Okay, yeah, I'm going to try it a few times while other people are talking. It doesn't work on you, but I don't know what kind of connection you... So if you hear my call letters come through when other people are talking, you'll know that it's working. I'm going to experiment with it while you guys are on the air in 2MB.
Thank you, Barry. Okay. Is there something unique about my transmission that the break function doesn't work? Let me turn it over to John, KC2WGB, K2RIW.
And for real.
This is KC2WGB. We'll run a little test here. I'll hold it. Let's see. Barry's just trying now, I think. And let's see if we heard anything. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Nope. I didn't hear anything during that transmission that Barry was trying. N2 Echo Oscar, K2LAW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay. I've been trying to get a hold of on the phone. I'll give him a call in a little while and repeat the shuts down in about 5 minutes where he can call me. And I was going to divert back to another subject you brought up, which was John's lightning strike. I had an antenna up. Barry put it up, he remembers, a number of years ago. It was about 10 feet vertical, peak of the roof. And it was up maybe a few months. It got hit. Half of it wound up in the neighbor's tree. They've had a problem like that before. Coax, which was on okay, but it's fried the antenna switch and an antenna tuner. I'm concerned with the global warming, and when you consider Hurricane Katrina, we're going to have a lot more of this back in there.
That's something to worry about as I see it, Rich. I'm not sure that global warming, it's only a couple of degrees per century. That's not the biggest variable you and I are going to worry about with lightning. And the number of amateur radio antennas that are struck by lightning seems to be amazingly small. I'm one of the tallest things around, and let me think now. I've had one major strike, which was not on my tower. It was in the neighborhood. The power line was struck in the neighborhood. A great big high voltage spike occurred through the through my 110 volt line, so to speak, and that damaged modems, computer, television set. Didn't affect refrigerator. Didn't affect any of the ham radio equipment. So lightning is pretty wicked stuff. You would think that my tower would be struck a lot more often, and not the local power line. Who knows? Although there is, let me drop. There is this paragraph in the New York City Fire Protection Code that at one time did say, and maybe it still does say, that there is no documented evidence of a habitable structure being damaged by lightning if it's adjacent to a well-grounded radio tower. That implies that 99% of the time, the radio tower takes the strike and the adjacent habitable structure is going to be relatively safe most of the time. So we hams, when we put up our antennas, as long as we've done a good job of grounding, I'd like to believe I'm the local lightning arrestor in my neighborhood. And that lightning strike of the power line in my neighborhood, I reasonably believe that strike was a number of blocks away. Anybody want to make any further questions or comments? Give me a call letters right now. K2RIW, the Tech Man.
GB with a comment.
You got it, John.
KC2WGB. One thing I don't understand, that antenna for my VLF receiver is about 70, 75 feet long, runs from north to south along the driveway. Well, just 10 feet from where that terminates on the north end are my two large vertical antennas on 3-inch galvanized pipe that are up about 40 feet in the air. Didn't go there. And that was way above the ground. Don't understand it. That antenna was at 12 feet. It just got vaporized. Can't count where it's going to go. It's just amazing.
I heard somebody say they've got a comment. I'm hearing them on the input, but not through the machine. Go ahead. Hear who that was?
WA2QBC with a comment.
You've got it, Bruce. You've got it, Bruce.
Okay, this is just something I'd like to relate. This was back in my teens when I was going to high school. And it was an 8-foot-story building. On top of it was just an antenna of about 250 feet. But the strike continued from my perspective past the tower. I don't think it was 8. Went straight down and hit the ground in the middle of the street.
Seconds after you started transmitting, Bruce, the machine went into its single sideband mode, if you know what I mean. So unfortunately, we did not copy what you said. Let's hope that it's been restored. Want to try again, Bruce?
K2RW, WA2QBC, the group. Yeah, I just wanted to relate a story. This is from my perspective, sitting in a classroom in high school back in the early 70s. And there was a lightning strike at my school. And the school is about 8 floors plus, steel frame, big brick fascia, with 450 feet of tower on top of it. So the total height of the tip of the tower is at about 600 feet. It was the old WNYE tower, on top of Brooklyn Tech. And from my perspective, the strike missed the tower, missed the building, went straight down through the middle of one of the courtyards in the figure eight structure of the building, and hit the ground in the center of the courtyard in the middle of one part of the building. And we jumped out of our seats and then some that day. But to me, it looked like it missed everything and just went straight to ground.
Yeah, very good transmission that time, Bruce. Wow. So you went to Brooklyn Tech High School on DeKalb Avenue, which is just down the road a piece from the school that I went to, Pratt Institute. Darn good school. And I think they had a number of HF antennas up on that roof of the, I think it's a six-story building. The way the polyphaser lightning catalog shows it is that lightning seems to always move in roughly 120-foot steps. So if you draw spheres with a 120-foot radius and try to pack them in tight against a radio tower, anything that's in that space left over is safe. The lightning won't go there. The story you just gave violates that philosophy, if you know what I mean. So that is a strange one. I guess some of the students were looking out the window at the time. That's how you know where the lightning bolt actually went, sir, Bruce. WQBC, KQRIW.
K2RAW in the group, WE2QBC. It was like a flashbulb went off, except the flashbulb was coming through the window from the outside, and yet some of us caught a glimmer of it, including myself, and it was very, very bright. There was damage on the ground. We knew exactly where the bulb hit. I didn't get a chance to inspect it because that part was locked off, but there was a small crater, and I imagine some melting and other things going on at the ground where the bulb impacted, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I forget the name that they use for this melted silicon. If a lightning bolt hits a chunk of sand, it brings the sand up to a high enough temperature that you really get this crazy glass structure left over. Sounds like you, I forget the name they use for that, but sounds like you guys got one of those. And I guess it's the backyard of the Brooklyn Tech High School. And I bet you that was a real loud lightning bolt, too. And so, because it's summertime, and I think that school is not air-conditioned, most likely a window is open. Therefore, you got the full blast of the audio. Is that true, Bruce? Over to you, Bruce, K2RIW.
Yeah, we got the full effect from both the sound and the light. At the time, the building wasn't air-conditioned. Now there are individual air conditioners in most of the classrooms and some of the other rooms. But at the time, no, the place wasn't air-conditioned. A lot of the windows were open. They had these big, monster, double-hung, sliding windows that were, oh, possibly about eight feet tall, 2 4-foot by 4-foot sections, give or take. Classic New York City school construction at the time. And this bolt went straight down. The building is a figure eight, so we have rooms on the outside of the eight and rooms on the inside of the eight. And I happen to be in one of those inside classrooms, and the bolt went straight on down and struck the ground. I don't remember the name of what happens when the ground of the sand fuses into glass, but there is a name for it. But we had that. It was another time we were trying to come back from a dive trip, and we're walking along about 50 feet off the beach in shallow water, and a lightning bolt struck the sand. Fortunately, it missed myself and my brother. We were pulling some diving from the sand, and I was feeling about the shallow water.
Dick, that vitrification of sand, is that Abyssinian or something like that?
Fulgurite?
Net, tonight at 8.
That sounds like it. Fulgurite. I think it's the one. We've hit the bewitching hour. You guys have just listened to TechNet number 1507, if my numbering system is right. I don't know if we settled anything. I had a great intention of giving you some more information about waveguide. You have to wait until next week. And I guess eventually Mike might even take each of those waveguide discussions and assemble them all in one spot. He occasionally does things like that. 73-year-old. Be kind to each other. Try not to get angry. And John, I'm going to send it back to you to tie some ribbons on it. KC2WGB. Thank you for all the monitoring tonight. KGYW and the TechNet.
Oh, my pleasure. No problem. Well, everybody, enjoy the week coming, and have a good time. Thank you for joining the net. And, very successful. We'll talk to you next week. Good night, Dick. Everyone around. KC2WGB. Clear.
I'm going to be talking to my wife, so I'm going to be at our frequency. Later on, I'm going to be there.
All right, I'll QSY there, and I've got some things here to do, so I'll be here for a little while longer. KC2WGB, clear.
I'm trying to reach you on the telephone. I'm going to call you on your hardwired phone. I'm going to try the hardwired phone. N2 microphone. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I'm trying to call him on the landline, but one of his phones is terrible. It doesn't work, so I'm trying to call him on the twisted pair, but that was more reliable. N2MB, Rockley Beach.
Disconnected.
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.